Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 16th of April 2015, and to kick off the summer term of programmes here at The Mind Renewed, not that it seems very much like summer yet, actually, but I'll say that in anticipation of some warmer weather to come, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the programme Nick Peters, who, as many of you will remember, joined us back in November to debate atheist author Ken Humphreys on the subject of the historicity of Jesus, about which we shall be saying quite a bit today, as the subject of our conversation is going to be very much related to that. But first, let me say that Nick Peters is a Christian apologist from Tennessee who, with his wife Ali, founded the Deeper Waters Christian Ministries, which is a web-based ministry currently featuring a very, very regular blog and weekly podcast in which Nick strives to interview the best in Christian scholarship and apologetics. Nick is also currently working on a master's degree in New Testament studies at Northwest University in South Africa, and his areas of interest are particularly the historical Jesus and the resurrection. Nick, welcome back to The Mind Renewed. It's very good to be chatting with you again.
It's very good to be here again. Hope I have just as much fun as I did last time.
Well, I hope you do. The only thing is we don't have Ken in the mix, and he's mm-hmm. a very entertaining personality, so we'll have to do the best between the two of us.
Yeah, I hope I can make up for things here.
Good, I hope you do. Well, I've had a coffee, so that, and I know you don't like coffee very much.
Pagan.
You don't like coffee, but that's certainly enlivened me. But I'm sorry to disappoint you there. I know you're a tea man yourself, aren't you?
Coffee was created by the devil to lead us away from tea. If anyone knows, that quote comes from Tim McGrew, and I happen to agree with it entirely.
And Tim McGrew, is he your supervisor?
No, he's not.
No, okay. But he is he a philosopher, Christian philosopher?
Yeah, he specializes in probability theory. He's at Western Michigan University, and he's one of the biggest names in the Facebook group, the Christian Apologetics Alliance.
And he has this theory about coffee.
No, he has this truth about coffee.
Anyway, how have you been getting on over the last few months after the debate?
Things have been going all right. Got a lot of good, positive feedback from it. It was a very enjoyable debate for me, and I think it really illustrates the bankruptcy of mythicism.
I very much enjoyed it as well, actually. It was a great experience. Have you had any negative responses from anybody?
Delivered to me personally, no. But, of course, I saw things going on, the YouTube links and such that Kim put up. And generally, my rule is don't bother with those, because anyone who speaks up anything in defense of Christianity, you're going to hear anything whatsoever being said. And generally, when I see these kinds of people, I can tell you haven't done the reading, you haven't done the research. Frankly, don't know what you're talking about.
It was actually really interesting, because I did get quite a few responses, mostly through email. And what I found particularly interesting about it was that those emails that I had from Christians tended to think that you wiped the floor with Ken, and those that I received from the other side tended to think exactly the opposite. And it was just interesting to see how people tend to sort of stick to their point of view, you know.
It's something that we do have a problem with today. Quite often, I mean, another show I listen to, for instance, is Unbelievable, which is normally a debate show. And I try to be honest when I can and listen and think, okay, I think the atheist is making a better case here. I do not agree with a case a lot of times, but I think he's making a better case. Because I'm willing to admit, if a Christian comes on and screws up, I was like, my gosh, don't have this guy come on here again. This is being embarrassing. One of the things that you're supposed to do when you're thinking about matters is to look at the case regardless of the person who holds it and just see, based on the argument, did they make a good case or not, even if you think it's a case you don't agree with for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, obviously, I think that you did actually make a better case, although I have to say that I think Ken probably made the better presentation, because that seems to be his skill. But I think as the debate went on, my own view anyway is that you won the debate, but that doesn't matter. Everybody has their own view of that.
Well, I would agree that my opening presentation probably wasn't the best, for one reason, because I wrote it out in advance, and I'm not used to doing something like that, but I want to have a key set of ideas out there, and it felt rushed. But then when we got into response times and such, I was moving much more into my element.
Yes, I agree. The whole thing became very much more enjoyable. When we got onto that Q&A, it was good. I was in my element as well there, and I felt a bit like a schoolmaster actually telling you both off.
Oh, yes.
But I enjoyed that. Anyway, so now before we get on to today's subject, which of course is going to be this Jesus mythicism, as it's called, as I believe the proponents of that call themselves mythicists, let's find out a little bit more about you, Nick. So the first question I want to ask here is, have you always been a Christian?
Of course not. No one's always been a Christian.
Okay, have you always been culturally a Christian in a sociological sense?
No, because I became a Christian at one point, so it wasn't just cultural.
Okay, let me ask it in a different way. Were you brought up in a Christian family, whether in terms of confessional Christian or sociological Christian?
Yes, I was raised in a Christian home. We went to church every Sunday, and it's kind of an oddity that when I went to Sunday school at my parents' church, and there was one church, the Methodist church we attended, and the Baptist church across the street.
You attended both Methodist and Baptist, did you?
No, I attended the Methodist one at first.
Good.
And it turned out we didn't have many youth. It would be either me and the teacher alone, or else I'd be the only boy. Now, later on in my teen years, I probably would have said glory hallelujah to that. But at the time, when you're a young boy, that's not the kind of thing you want too much. So I walked across the street to the Baptist church because they had a better youth group, including some of my friends from school. And I guess that's where I think I really heard the message for the first time and thought, well, you know, this sounds like a pretty good deal. I think I'll go with it. That's when I say I became a Christian. And when I got into apologetics, that was when I was in high school, I started having panic attacks and depression, kind of thinking the idea that I'd been raised Christian and became a Christian, but, you know, what if I really hadn't? What if I was living a life that wasn't pleasing to God for whatever reason and such? And this was an incredibly painful time in my life. And somehow, actually, I wound up at Bible college, and I found out about apologetics. And so I just started reading and reading and reading more and more. My parents were starting to panic every time I went to the bookstore because I came home with a load of books. And I can say I never received a clear answer to my questions that were bothering me at the time. But today I do have the answer, even though I wasn't really looking for that answer, because I found out about how true the life of Jesus is, and that, you know, this stuff isn't just words on a page. It actually happened. It just blew my mind. And where was this stuff all my life? Why wasn't anyone telling me about this? That's why I stress so much discipleship, that we need to get to a stage where we're really sitting down and examining what we really believe and trying to say, put my feelings aside on the matter for now. What does the evidence say? Can I go with this evidence?
Yeah, and you, as you explained when we had the debate, you and your wife both have been diagnosed with Asperger's. And what kind of impact does that have on your life and particularly your work as an apologist?
It's kind of a mixed bag in some ways, although overall I'd say the bag is positive for me. Now, I'll start with some negative aspects. I have a very hard time with socialization. Yeah, I'll go and I'll debate the atheists and such for fun, but if you talk about my going out with a church and doing door-to-door evangelism, that sounds utterly terrifying, especially if I have to suddenly speak and introduce myself to people I don't know. What I could do is I could go with a group, and if a group got a conversation started, then yeah, I could jump in. But doing something like that, no. And I can react very fearfully to many, many situations. If I get scared of something, I get extremely scared of something. Climbing stairs sometimes can be extremely frightening for me. Actually, water is something big. I was at the beach when I was young, very young, and the undertow decided to say hello to me, and I wasn't prepared for that. And I've been terrified of water like that ever since. Allie has to really work with me a lot whenever we go to the beach or a pool or anything like that. We also usually have unusual diets. Allie is texture-oriented. She doesn't like the fear of certain things. For me, I'm sight-oriented. I don't like anything that's messy, for instance. And I will only eat foods that I can eat with my hands. And even if Ari does something like, say, wow, has toast for breakfast in the morning, has a paper plate left over, and she's like, can you throw this away from me? I'll still be a good husband and throw it away. But when I'm heading to a trash can, I feel like I'm handling hazardous waste or something. I can't even look if there's a crumb on there. So, yes, that's kind of what it's like. I mean, if you've ever seen the TV series Monk, I really relate to Adrian Monk. But with the positives is that my mind can really concentrate on many things at once. My parents used to say they could come into my room when I was in high school and such, and I'd have a video game that I was playing. I'd be listening to the radio, and there was a smaller TV on top of the TV I was using for video games, so I'd be watching cartoons on there. And I knew what was going on and everything.
Wow, that is amazing, yeah. That's the complete opposite of me, because I can only do one thing at a time, and my wife would tell you that.
And I've got a very good memory in this regard. So I like to do things with memorization, and if I read something, it's much more prone to stick with me. I can see the connections a whole lot faster, I think, than a lot of other people can. It's just really good memory recall, do things with numbers and such. It's kind of odd that my wife thinks I've got some form of ADD, that it can be hard for me to really stay on and a subject if I'm finding it boring or if there's not enough for me to do. I mean, my in-laws have, for instance, gotten used to the fact that when I'm talking to them when we all visit, I very well could have my phone or my Kindle out playing a game on it at the same time while I'm talking to them. They thought I was being rude at first, but then they realized his mind needs to be constantly occupied and he needs more. I mean, that's probably one reason why I can be so anxious a lot of times when I go to sleep at night, because I've only got one thing to think about then, and sometimes it can be a very bad thing. But it's the way the mind works. And in studying autism and Asperger's and things like that, it's really fascinating. And I would urge you to do that, especially since this month in America, at least, is Autism Awareness Month.
Do you feel that this condition that you have, I mean, from a Christian point of view and making sense of your life with respect to the gospel, do you think that that in some ways is something that God has given you? I think you said something like that in the debate, that you consider it to be a gift.
I do see it actually as a gift for me. And yes, it even led to my meeting my wife, who's on the spectrum. And it's a real oddity because my wife struggles with it a lot more. We've said that if ever there came a cure out for autism Asperger's, she would want to take it, and that could probably do her good. I would turn it down. You mean, I said, don't you dare get near me with that stuff. I don't want it. I see it as a gift that my mind works in a way that I consider unique. It's got its burdens here. I mean, just seeing here, I've got some cans from some juice I've been drinking. I just had to suddenly arrange them more properly here. Mm. Yeah, that kind of obsessiveness can be a problem sometimes, but the benefits outweigh the cost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, as I said, today we're going to be talking about this Jesus mythicism, otherwise known Christ myth theory or Jesus myth theory, known in various ways. And, of course, this is the hypothesis that the person, Jesus of Nazareth, who we read about in the New Testament, never existed, or if he did exist, then he had nothing to, or hardly anything to do with Christianity, or the claimed accounts of his ministry in the New Testament at all. But beyond that, of course, mythicists are obliged to deal with the data of Christianity.
Everyone is.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. So the information that we've got in the New Testament, the existence of the church itself is data, the possible references to Jesus outside the Christian writings, etc., etc., and provide some kind of hypothesis that supposedly is superior to simply accepting at face value that Jesus existed, you know, and that the New Testament, the church, arose out of the ministry of this historical person. So we have to look at some of these ideas to see if there's anything to them. But can we start with just a very brief glance back at the past history of this idea? When we spoke before the interview, you named one German scholar who, back in the 19th century, was interested in this kind of idea, Bruno Bauer. Do you want to tell us anything about him?
Well, he was the one who really, I'd say, in many ways, got this kind of ball rolling. And it was becoming pretty extreme, because they say that the gospel is only about, what about all these references to Pilate? Oh, Pilate didn't exist. Caiaphas. Oh, Caiaphas didn't exist. All these people just didn't exist. And unfortunately, we've found more and more evidence that these figures that are talked about, they really are existing people. I mean, my gosh, we found Caiaphas's burial box. We have the slab of Pilate. We've got these things more and more. Archaeology tends to come up more and more on the side of a Bible. I find that very interesting. And then we've got extra-biblical cooperation, of course. And Tacitus talks about Pontius Pilate. And interestingly, he talks about Pilate only one time. And that is the one time he talks about Jesus as well.
Yeah, great. We're going to come on to that business about Tacitus' writing in a little bit. And certainly back in the 19th century, I suppose, Bruno Bauer writing back then, it was easier for him to discount certain evidences that might be, say, written down, because say, well, there's no archaeological evidence of such and such. And then, as you say, in the middle of the 20th century, along comes this. I mean, I've seen it. We went to Israel and we saw it ourselves. It was a reproduction, but this slab with Pontius Pilate's name on it. And of course, the original was kept in a museum. But nevertheless, there was this faithful reproduction of it. I think it was 1961 it was discovered or something like that. And then suddenly, you know, Bruno Bauer's words fall to the ground. Now, before Bruno Bauer, just to be very brief about this, I understand that this kind of idea gestated really in the French late 18th century Enlightenment with thinkers, and I've got just a couple of names here. I know nothing about them other than they went for this kind of idea, Volney and Dupuy. And then, as you say, we have Bruno Bauer. And then jumping forward in the 19th century, we have names which people more likely to know. Kersey Graves, who was a 19th century American schoolteacher, apparently argued for pagan influences on the Gospels. And a guy called Gerald Massey, who taught himself to read Egyptian hieroglyphics and apparently argued that the character of Jesus owed a lot to the Egyptian god Horus. And, of course, that's been picked up in recent years, has it not?
This kind of stuff, it's because of the internet, largely, where we have clear evidence that zombies exist on the internet, because dead arguments rise up to live again anew constantly. Kersey Graves, the 16 crucified saviors, some of those we can't even find, like the Boodaloo of Japan. I mean, who is this guy? It's still a mystery, and there aren't footnotes. I got up my copy and looked a second ago, but yeah, I'm not seeing any footnotes here. And then when we get to Gerald Massey, much later Egyptology has shown that his claims really don't match up. And what needs to be asked is, okay, what professional peer-reviewed PhD Egyptologists today are really talking seriously about Massey's work? See, if an idea is true and it's got evidential power to it, you don't need to go back 100 or 150 years or so to find it. You'll find people are still arguing for it today. And I'm talking not just people on the internet, I'm talking about real scholars who are publishing in scholarly fields.
Yes, we will later come back to that question about who is a real scholar and who isn't. I don't want you to answer that at the moment. We'll come back to that because Ken Humphreys brought that up in the debate. I want to skip on to these names that are more up to date, because we have a list of them here. I know that most of what we say today will centre in these guys. And we have, he's still alive, I believe, G.A. Wells,
yes.
Who I understand was a lecturer in German at London University, which is my alma mater. Do you want to say anything about him?
Well, I understand actually now that G.A. Wells has come to be open to a historical Jesus. But, I mean, yeah, I've read his work, and it relies on much material that really was quite outdated at the time. And a lot of mythicists use the same kinds of arguments, arguments from silence, those kinds of things. And whatever aspect I try to do when I read any work whatsoever, Christian, non-Christian, whatever, I want to go to the bibliography as much as I can and look and say, are these guys interacting with the other side? Do they take the best of their critics and deal with them? Do they use the most recent sources? And one example I'd use, for instance, is Bart Ehrman's last book they came out with, is How Jesus Became God. I've read it. It's a good book in many ways, but I was checking the data to see what he was arguing against. For instance, I notice he dismisses miracles very quickly, but he never interacts with Craig Keener, who has written a massive two-volume tome on miracles. And even if you think Keener's claims are nonsense, they should at least be taken seriously. And he never mentions Richard Bauckham, who would be his biggest critic. He mentions Larry Hurtado a couple of times, but he never interacts with the arguments Hurtado makes for the early views of Jesus as fully deity. And when I see this, I think this is highly problematic, because it sounds like I'm just getting one side of a story. And yes, I'll do the same thing to a Christian book if they do the exact same thing, because if you're arguing the case, you need to bring forward the best of what your other side has to say and say, and here's why I argue against it.
And so did you feel that G.A. Wells was guilty of that academic error?
No, I thought he was.
You thought he was?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't feel it, I thought it.
Right, okay. Well, that is a synonym, as far as I'm concerned, I'm afraid. Maybe that's a British thing, but because we tend to understate things, so...
Actually, N.T. Wright was on Unbelievable one time even, and he said the same kind of thing. He said, we use the word feel when we should use the word think, and we must be clear on what we're doing.
Well, now you're clear. When I say feel, I'm more than likely mean think. So can you...
I know, but I'm still sarcastic.
Okay, so we got other people, haven't we? Earl Doherty and Robert mm-hmm. Price. I mean, obviously, I don't want you to go into all the details yet about what they think. We'll come to some of that in a minute. But do you want to tell us anything about those two guys?
Well, Earl Doherty, I mean, what I see people asking are, what are this guy's credentials? I mean, Ben Witherington really wrote a scathing review of the Jesus Pezzer, and it was so scathing that he was typing in caps. If you want to think about Ben Witherington yelling, this is the closest I've seen. This is a guy who I've seen do many talks, and he's always calm and friendly, even when I interviewed him one time on my own show. And here, like, oh my gosh, he's about to explode on this guy. And he is not a historian. He's not even familiar with the historical subjects which he wants to pontificate on.
And he specifically does deny that Jesus ever existed. Or he argues that Jesus never existed. Yeah. And Robert Price also argues for that position, but he does have a PhD and apparently has some kind of professorial position.
Well, if he has a professorial position somewhere, it's one I'm not really familiar with.
Well, I know you don't like me referring to Wikipedia, and I understand that. But I do understand that, but I reserve it for those cases where it's not controversial, and I think this is probably not controversial, and this is that he is apparently a professor of biblical criticism at the Center for Inquiry Institute, which is affiliated in some way to the State University of New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I would want to check in looking into that is, you know, is this a place that's accredited? I mean, that, because it really sounds more like an institute in that regards. But, yeah, we'll see what happens. But I do avoid Wikipedia like the plague. I mean, if you're looking at things like, say, a movie or a video game or something like that, yeah, I don't have much problem. But for serious subjects, I prefer to say that Wikipedia is the abomination that causes misinformation.
Okay, well, I pretty much agree with you. However, there is a little bit of data there that may suggest that he does, in fact, have some kind of academic position. But that wouldn't be the case with Richard Carrier, who does actually have a PhD, I understand, in ancient history. But is that right? He doesn't have an academic position.
No, he doesn't. It seems like to me that when I see Richard Carrier's name brought up, he is the end R in biblical scholarship to atheism. If Richard Carrier says it, the case is closed. I mean, Carrier has spoken, the case is closed. It's just not the way it is, because in the mainstream academy that I see, I don't see a lot of people interacting with Carrier's work. I mean, I've got a friend over there in Scotland, and he said he's gone to his professors, and he's studying at a university over there with very prestigious scholars. And you mentioned Carrier, say, who?
However, I will bring up one person, Dennis MacDonald, who apparently is John Wesley Professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at the Claremont School of Theology in California. Mm-hmm. And he does have this controversial theory that the Gospel of Mark owes something to the writings of Homer, and so shouldn't be taken as historical as we normally do take it to be. Mm. And he's a he's somebody who is, you know, has actually got a chair in the New Testament.
Yeah, that's not the same as mythicism, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's take the claim at face value. Let's suppose that Mark, when he wrote, modeled a lot of what he did after the Homeric epics. So what? How does that automatically demonstrate, therefore, this is not historical? I mean, all it would show is Mark is using a kind of form to write that he finds appealing. If you want to know if it's historical, you need to look at Mark itself, although I'd say Mark and others belong more in the realm of Greco-Roman biographies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so do you know of anybody beyond the list that we've been just discussing here who, in terms of academic positions, holds a more prestigious position?
No, I really don't, at least not in New Testament scholarship. There could be some Old Testament scholars who hold that position, or scholars in other fields. You can find several PhD philosophers, for instance, who could be mythicists, but they're not historians, they're not biblical scholars, so that really doesn't matter too much.
Okay, so let me throw at you this challenge, which Ken Humphreys did bring up, and that is the idea that we could point to all sorts of people who hold bona fide positions within universities, but we could say, well, they don't question the existence of Jesus because they've been schooled in a certain kind of way, and it doesn't matter whether they're Christian or not, they were nevertheless schooled in a certain kind of approach to doing their history, and so they're within a paradigm, and they can't see outside that paradigm, and it's left to highly intelligent people outside of those institutions who are freed from that paradigm and then therefore can do this kind of controversial research. What do you say to that kind of argument?
You know, what we have been taught really is simply how to do history, and when we do history this way, we should use the same standards for Jesus that we would use for anyone else. I am thoroughly opposed to double standards. I really don't like that the New Testament is often treated far differently from other works of ancient history. And when scholars go and make their cases, they have to make a case before people who could very well disagree with our position and pass peer review. It doesn't mean their case is correct. It means they can defend their case adequately. What Humphreys and others are looking at, it's more of a, what I consider a conspiracy theory mindset, that there is some big cover-up of sorts. And now that the internet is coming out there, then we're finding out that the people in charge have shown us something different, and we're going to get to the truth because all these people have bad motives, but our motives are good and pure.
Well, I'm going to challenge you there, Nick, on a couple of counts. And one is that I think the term conspiracy theory is really, I think it's a descriptive term. I don't think it's an evaluative term, because there can be good conspiracy theories and there can be bad ones, and it has to do with the evidence that's there.
Right.
So that isn't necessarily a criticism. But then again, I'm thinking that Ken actually, his point doesn't really entail that, because as I was saying to you, it's about a paradigm. I think his point is about a paradigm, that these scholars have been trained in a certain way, and so it's very difficult for them to stand outside of that. And that state of affairs has perpetuated itself, and it's only these writers who stand outside of the institutions who can see things more clearly. Now, I'm not arguing for that. I'm just saying that, I think, is Ken's position.
Well, let's consider how far we can go with that. Should we say that flat earthers might have a case because all these other people have been raised in a paradigm that teaches that the earth is round? Should we say geocentrists have a case? Would Ken Humphreys want to say creationists have a case because everyone else has been raised in an evolutionary paradigm? Would he want to say young earthers have a case because everyone else has been raised in an old earth paradigm? One thing we might want to consider is maybe these paradigms last because they have better evidential power and can explain the data. And if he wants to introduce a new paradigm, more power to him. But what he's going to have to do is show the old paradigm is flawed, how it is flawed, why it is flawed, and how the new paradigm better explains the data. I mean, yes, old paradigms pass away sometimes, but they need serious evidence before a totally new paradigm is accepted.
Agreed. And so that's what we need to do. We certainly need to look at some of the evidence that's put forward to see if the paradigm that you and I accept that Jesus did exist is worthy of continuing to accept, which I believe it is, and I know that you'd believe it is. But we'll look at some of these ideas. Now, there's no way, of course, that we're going to be able to cover even the arguments put forward by one writer, let alone, you know, half a dozen that we've been talking about here. That's going to that would take us hours. So I think the best thing to do is just to explore a few themes that seem to be common to some of them. I've got a few specifics to throw in here and there. Now, what I'm doing here, and I'm going to make this quite clear, is that I'm going to be playing devil's advocate, which I already have done a little bit, and it therefore sounds like I'm going to be advocating these mythicist ideas. But I'm only doing that to facilitate the conversation. I'm saying this because just recently I've had a number of comments from people wondering if, in fact, I actually believe what I'm saying when I ask questions like this. Now, I'm just playing devil's advocate, so I thought I'd better say that. So can we start with what we might consider to be a foundational argument of this position, and that is the contention that the sources of information we have about Jesus of Nazareth are far too untrustworthy for one reason or another. We cannot rely upon them to give us any real information about this historical character, so therefore we have reasons to think he's not historical. And this breaks down into two categories. We can't trust the New Testament itself, with all its Gospels and letters and other writings, and also we can't trust the purported mentions of Jesus in non-Christian writings from antiquity either. So can we start with the New Testament sources? Now, I'm taking a lead here from an article by Earl Doherty, who we've mentioned, and this article is called The Jesus Puzzle, surprisingly enough, published in 1997 by the Journal of Higher Criticism, which I understand is now discontinued, and the editor-in-chief was Robert Price, so I don't know what that tells us anything, but...
It tells us a lot.
Anyway, so how do you respond to these arguments that we should doubt the historical value of the New Testament itself?
Generally, I think when we approach ancient documents of any kind, we should seek to be fair to the document, and until evidence comes in contrary, we should be willing to kind of give a face value thing on things that we have no evidence for or against either way, and realize that in many cases, if we don't have any strong evidence for or against, and we're still skeptical, that maybe we can be skeptical. But we shouldn't bank everything just on our attitudes that we bring to the text. I mean, for instance, Herodotus has a story about a mare that gave birth to a hare. Now, this is supposed to be some strange phenomena that takes place as portents and such. Now, if I'm looking at something like that, I'd say, well, you know, I do believe strange things could have happened. Sure, but, you know, all I see here is just a simple claim. I see nothing else that backs it other than the claim itself. There's no sociological ramifications that come from it. So while I'm inclined to be skeptical because I just don't think that kind of thing happens, if something else came forward, I could say, yeah, maybe, but I at the same time don't want to write off stories of miraculous events and say, well, that didn't happen because miracles don't happen. It's okay to be skeptical, but it's not okay to let your skepticism dictate what you're going to do. Now, as for using the Bible, you know, I have a quote here. If historians want to know what Jesus said and did, they are more or less constrained to use the New Testament Gospels as their principal sources. Let me emphasize that this is not for religious or theological reasons. For instance, that these and these alone can be trusted. It is for historical reasons, pure and simple. Now, this quote comes from the highly Christian fundamentalist scholar Bart Ehrman in his introduction to the New Testament, his guide that he uses for his own students in the New Testament. And as we know, Bart Ehrman, he's just a Christian steeped in fundamentalism seeking to defend the historical Jesus. That's all it is.
Well, yeah, anybody who listened to The Mind Renewed for any length of time will know that you're being sarcastic there for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Although I wouldn't be being sarcastic, I think he does have too much of a fundamentalist background.
Yes, indeed. And that was interesting. We had a conversation with Robert Bowman about Bart Ehrman, and that came out, actually, that he had this, that Bart Ehrman had this fundamentalist background, and that colours his interpretation and his approach of what he's doing these days.
Craig Evans has said, in fact, that he thinks Bart Ehrman is on a flight from fundamentalism.
Yes, I do very much get that kind of impression. Let me bring up one specific thing, then. This comes from Earl Doherty, and he says that the New Testament Gospels contradict one another. He says they are irreconcilable, and he says such as the baptism and nativity stories, the finding of the empty tomb, and Jesus' post-resurrection appearances, plus myriad other contradictions and disagreements in the accounts of Jesus' words and deeds. So there we are. He's throwing out contradictions. We can't trust the New Testaments at all, therefore.
Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, now, I do hold the inerrancy. My ministry partner and I co-wrote a book together on inerrancy. So I do hold it. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that there are irreconcilable contradictions in the accounts. Okay? So what? What does this prove? It doesn't prove anything, because all it is this is more of a fundamentalist mindset where it says it's all or nothing. Either a text is totally reliable in everything, or if it's shown to be unreliable in something, we can't trust it in anything. I mean, this is the kind of thinking that Frank Zindler uses in his argument, where if he finds what he thinks is a mistake in Luke, well, gee, so much for Luke being a reliable historical source. You go and you do that with any other document of ancient history, you're going to know hardly anything about ancient history. If we look at a text and say, because X contradicts Y, therefore X and Y are both false, well, that would be silly. That doesn't make sense. Maybe it could be X is right here and Y is wrong. Well, maybe Y is right somewhere and X is wrong. It's not an all-or-nothing game, and all-or-nothing thinking is some of the worst kind of thinking that we do. We have two accounts of how Hannibal crossed the Alps and came to Rome, for instance. We have Polybius, we have Livy. They hopelessly contradict. Find me a historian who doubts this happened, though. Okay, this is something that's accepted. Mike Lacona is really doing some excellent research on this, and his book should be coming out, I think, next year. It's going to be on Plutarch and the Gospels as Greco-Roman Bible, and showing how the same writer, Plutarch, has differences in his accounts of the exact same event. But these differences could be allowable in the genre of Greco-Roman biography. And what I would advise people to do, if they're really concerned about contradictions, go to a library, preferably a library at a seminary or Bible college that specializes in this kind of thing. Read the best scholarship you can find, and read both sides by all means, and see who makes the best case. The important thing is that I don't believe in the resurrection because I believe in the Bible. I believe in the Bible because I believe in the resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus comes first. I hold to inerrancy, but if inerrancy is false, it's false. But I still have a case for a resurrection of Jesus that does not depend on inerrancy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I find interesting about this is from my own reading of biblical studies is that, you know, these supposed contradictions or these differences between the Gospels actually give biblical scholars something to work with, in a way. Yeah. And they can actually work through this and come to various kinds of conclusions about what actually did happen. And so, you know, this immediately strikes me as a bit of a weak position. So let me just throw another one at you then. So this is, again, Earl Doherty writing, saying that modern scholarship has shown that the Gospel writers were writing for their specific faith communities, which means they were less interested in history than in the needs of their particular communities. And this is the quote: so even the purported words of the Lord could be arbitrarily changed or invented for tendentious reasons. There could be no thought of preserving history.
Okay, that's like the first part, that the writers were writing for specific faith communities, so they weren't really interested in history. How does that follow? Because I have a specific audience in mind when I'm writing about someone, therefore I'm not interested in being historical. It could be, but there's no necessity that I see going on there. In fact, if you're wanting to make sure these people are able to defend their views in a public square, you could find you'd be more interested in making sure that you were being historical. Bias can work both ways. I mean, we could say that Jews, for instance, could put together Holocaust museums for other Jews, so other Jews can learn about what happened, and this kind of thing can never happen again. And you say, they're biased. Yes, of course they're biased. That's the point. Everyone who writes anything whatsoever, history or anything at all, has a bias. Bias is unavoidable. I have a bias. You have a bias. Doherty has a bias. Ehrman has a bias. Mike Lacona has a bias. Gary Habermas has a bias. Every single person on this planet has a bias.
Nick?
Yeah?
I don't have a bias.
Yeah, you do.
I was being sarcastic. I was getting you
yes.
back.
Yes. Yes, I know, and I wasn't putting up with it. We all have biases. The thing is, we have to learn to keep our biases in check, and that's why it's so essential that we bring our ideas to other people who disagree, and we allow them to test our ideas. Now, as for the idea of making up things, this strikes me as particularly bizarre, because these communities were, for the most part, outside of the Jerusalem area, and a lot of times they were consisting of Gentiles, for instance. Why would you make up a story of Jesus dealing with issues relating to the Sabbath? Why would you make up issues of Jesus talking about circumcision? No one was discussing these kinds of issues seriously in this way. If you were one to do this, you would go with more issues that were talked about in the Pauline epistles. You would have Jesus making a statement on food offered to idols, or you would have him making a statement about what happens if you marry an unbeliever, or you would have him making a statement about any number of things that were going on in the Gentile world that weren't as prevalent in the Jewish world. But the Gospels tend to deal very much with highly Jewish issues, and many of them relating to the Jewish land itself. Why would this be made up?
Okay, well, that leads neatly on to the next criticism. This is that so many elements of the Jesus story rely on passages and motifs from the Jewish scriptures. So the Passion story is, he says, a pastiche of verses from the Psalms and Isaiah and various other prophets. It represents a new telling of a tale found repeatedly throughout the Hebrew Bible and related writings. So there's no history in view here. It's midrash. It's just sort of cobbled together from Old Testament passages.
Well, Midrash does not necessitate making things up. And we could use this same kind of argument to show the Qumran community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls never existed. How do we know? Well, geez, if you look at what this supposed community said about itself, they saw themselves as a fulfillment of the Old Testament, and they interpreted the Old Testament to point to them. So obviously, they're not writing about a historical group. These must be some later writers who are making up a Qumran sect for whatever reason. It doesn't follow. I mean, for the people back then, the Old Testament was their bread and butter. And if you wanted to show Jesus was the Messiah who fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies, this might be a shock, but it could help to quote the Old Testament sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, I think that one falls to the ground pretty quickly. So let's go for another one. So this is that Mark, he says, basically, it's our only narrative source for Jesus' life and ministry. If we take it as generally accepted that Mark's gospel comes first out of the four, and Luke and Matthew, therefore, are dependent on Mark. And he also says that Acts is full of unhistorical stuff. We don't really take that seriously. He says Acts 2, as an historical witness to Jesus or the beginnings of the Christian movement, cannot be relied upon, he says. Okay, so we just have Mark that has this narrative source for Jesus' life, and everything follows from that. So this is just one source that we're basing all this on?
First off, there are many things in ancient world that we believe in based on one source at a time. That's not a problem. Just because we have one source doesn't necessitate that the whole thing is false. But it's really bizarre when I hear something like this, because we're told the Gospels hopelessly contradict one another in one breath, and we're saying the Gospels all use the same source. Now, that doesn't make sense to me. I think if they're all using the same source, we're just copying, we should have everything spelled out very clearly. Now, there are a lot of interesting theories on relation between the synoptics, I mean Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Mark Goodacre has done a lot of work in this area. I find it very interesting. I interviewed him because he's one that actually argues against the Q hypothesis, which I'm more inclined right now to go that way, but that's neither here nor there. I'm very skeptical. Sure. I like the idea of that Vince Carter.
Yeah, I actually agree with you. I'm very inclined towards this Mark without Q view of Mark Goodacre. And I've approached him, actually, and I'm very much hoping that he will join us later in the summer. So anyway, this Q, this is the from the German word Quelle, isn't it, meaning source, and this is the hypothetical source of sayings, essentially. And that's deduced from the fact that these sayings are not found in Mark's Gospel, but they are common to both Luke and Matthew. So it looks, if you go with this theory, that it looks like there is this common source of sayings that Luke and Matthew have drawn upon. But that isn't a narrative source, so we're still stuck just with Mark as the only narrative source that we're basing the Jesus story upon.
That really doesn't make sense. Luke and Matthew are both narratives. They just use different sources. Now, some people will raise the objection, Matthew was supposed to be one of Jesus' apostles. Why would he use a source by Mark, who was not one of Jesus' apostles? I see this come up constantly, and it baffles me because it's really so simple. If we accepted the tradition that's usually there, that Mark was writing on behalf of Peter, and Richard Bauckham has made a pretty good case that Mark is an inclusio account with Peter. And in fact, if the early church was willing to make up a name for this gospel, they would more likely go, well, geez, let's see, who are the two candidates? We have Peter, strong leader of the apostles. Yeah, he denied Jesus, but he was reinstated, and he's the head honcho when it comes to the apostles. We can use him, or we can use Mark, little sissy boy who ran back home to his mama and caused a split between Paul and Barnabas, the first great missionaries of the gospel. Which of these two do we want to say wrote this gospel? If you were just making it up, you would choose Peter every time. But they chose Mark, because I believe they really thought Mark wrote it. So why does this matter here? If Mark is telling Peter's account, Peter is part of the inner three of the 12 apostles. And we see many cases in the Gospels where Jesus takes just the inner three somewhere, such as the raising of Jairus' daughter or the transfiguration. Matthew would not have seen these events. So maybe he would want to use a source then that comes from Peter. That makes perfect sense. And when I read the Gospels, actually, I like both Matthew and Luke for different reasons. Matthew, he's very messianic in his writings. I like to see the connections that he makes. The hope of Israel comes out dominant, I think, in his writings. But Luke is the historian par excellence. He's very evidential in what he says. I like that.
Well, that, see, is something that's challenged here with saying that the Book of Acts, which is normally reckoned to be Luke's second volume, Luke first and then the Book of Acts following. And the claim here is that Acts is not worth considering in terms of history. And I find that a difficult position to come to terms with. I mean, I've got here a book which I bought quite a few years ago, actually, which I think... Just,
is it by Colin Hemer?
It is indeed, the Book of Acts in the setting of Hellenistic history. And it is just packed with, saying things like, well, if Luke, identifies, some official in the Mediterranean or something, he gets the exact, the right word to describe that person. He's been very meticulous.
I mean, we thought Luke was wrong on many things, such as Asiarchs. Now we found, I think, three references to Asiarchs. One of my favorite stories to talk about is Tim McGrew's talk about someone who's written a book on this. It was written several years ago, probably over a century ago, who was very skilled as a seaman, someone who knows how to live at sea and such. And when he wrote his book, he went through Acts 27, the famous ship voyage of Paul. And he says, the writer of this account was an eyewitness. He was right there at the time. But at the same time, he wasn't familiar with boats that much. He did not use the terminology that someone skilled with boats would use, but he used the terminology that a witness would use who was there at the time. And his conclusion was that this is an account of someone who was there present. And the work, it's over 300 pages long. I don't remember the name exactly, but those who are wanting it, they can contact Tim McGrew, and I'm sure Tim McGrew will know it immediately and be able to tell him how to get it. And it's one of those books that you could get for free on Google Books. So there's some bonus free books. Who doesn't like that?
Absolutely, yeah. So if you send me that information, that would be great. I could put that in the notes. That would be fantastic.
Sure.
Okay, well, let's turn to the non-Christian sources then. So we have mentions of Jesus or mentions of Christians in the writing, people like Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, and it's often put forward as supporting evidence for the historical reality of Jesus. Indeed, Dr. Paul Meyer joined us on the show just about a year ago, and he argued
very vociferously.
Yes, indeed, that's right. For the authenticity of the famous passage in Josephus's Antiquities, the Testimonium Flavianum, if I've said that correctly. But there are other people who, Mark Goodacre said this in one of his podcasts, that he no longer uses these as strong evidence because they don't provide as watertight a case as he would. And of course, the classic rebuttal to using these as evidences is that even if the references to Jesus are original there in those writings, maybe the writer in question got that reference from a Christian source in some way. So maybe it doesn't actually prove to be an independent source at all. Anyway, I just wonder if you would like to say anything about. I know that you do argue that Tacitus and perhaps I think Josephus as well can be used very usefully in this regard. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, there's no doubt that with the testimony of Josephus, there is some Christian interpolation in there. But the majority of scholars in the field will say that it's only partial interpolation. We can find many things in there still about the historical Jesus. Now, some people say, well, why wasn't Josephus quoted then more often? Well, because for the early church, it really wasn't that relevant. The things that are being questioned today by mythicists weren't being questioned by the early church. I mean, even one of the first early critics of Christianity, Celsus, he never once denied Jesus existed. In fact, he never even denied Jesus did miracles. He said Jesus got his dark powers by studying in Egypt, for instance. None of the early critics denied Jesus existed. So why would you make a quote of Josephus and say, see, even Josephus says Jesus existed, when none of your opponents are saying that? Now, when it comes to Tacitus, Tacitus could very well be the most thorough of Roman historians. I mean, his best friend was Pliny, and even he didn't accept everything Pliny said at face value. He tried to check it out as much as he could. And why would he go to the Christians themselves? Because Tacitus did not care for the Christians. He didn't even really care for the Jews too much. Why would he use such a source? Now, Tim O'Neill, he interestingly suggests that maybe there was a Jew that Tacitus used as a source, and maybe that would have been Josephus, who was there at the time. That's a possibility, but it could be that Tacitus just did have access to records in Rome that, quite frankly, don't exist anymore, but he knew how to get the information where. I mean, this guy was a senator. He had access to information.
Do you attach any significance to the fact that the original reading of the word Christians in the Tacitus passage is Christians and seems to have been changed to Christians?
No, I don't really think that's much of significance. I don't think any scholars of Tacitus really think as much of significance either. Some, I think he could have been correcting Suetonius or maybe even being sarcastic a little bit about Suetonius.
Okay, if we go back to the Josephus passage, the Testimonium Flavianum, now this does have some very grandiose language about Jesus. So for those people who haven't listened to the interview with Paul Meyer, let me just quote this. So this is from the Antiquities, so this is 18.3.3. Now there was, about this time, Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure, he drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of the Christians so named from him are not extinct at this day. And as Paul Meyer says, that almost certainly containing, as you say, Christian interpolation.
Definitely. I do not conceive any world where Josephus would have said Jesus was a Christ and not be a Christian himself, as well as affirming the resurrection. You know, if you were doing that, you would be a Christian. So, yeah, there is some interpolation, but that doesn't mean wholesale invention, particularly since later on there's another reference to Jesus, the brother of James, in fact. And this reference, when I see it, it's Josephus can say, you know who this Jesus is. I mentioned him back there.
Okay, yeah. So this other mention here of Jesus within the Josephus writing, but mythicists have argued that this is a different Jesus being referred to here, the Jesus son of Damnaeus, who Josephus says this guy, Jesus son of Damnaeus, was replacing the high priest at the time. So maybe he's talking about that Jesus here.
It's very unusual to identify a person by their brother. You would normally identify them by their father. And we have a pretty clear idea who this Jesus was, and no indication that this other Jesus was a brother of James. It's you probably wouldn't have a brother who's got two brothers of the same name, for instance. Again, most Josephus scholars would say, yeah, this is still the same Jesus here. And it hasn't switched. And you could find two different Jesuses being talked about in a work. That wouldn't be uncommon, because Jesus was an extremely common name in the time of the New Testament. I was posting somewhere on Facebook recently about this kind of thing, and someone brought up the name of Mary. I said, yes, if you were walking down the street in first century Israel, saw a woman and said, hi, Mary, you had a 1 in 4 chance of being correct.
Okay, so when he identifies these various Jesuses, you're saying he's very clear about it, and so we shouldn't think that he's been lax just when it comes to describing the brother of Jesus in this passage.
Yeah, I think Josephus is certainly pointing back to an earlier reference. He's not pointing to something later on. Since he identifies this guy by his brother, that tells us a lot. James had a famous brother.
Okay, if we go back to that passage that we looked at first, the testimony of Flavianum, then Dr. Meyer came up with his own translation of what he thinks it originally probably was. And I think he's basing this on an Arabic version that...
That's what I've heard too.
Yeah, that testifies to an original version. It goes like this. At that time there was a wise man named Jesus, whose life was perfect, his virtues were recognized, and many Jews and Gentiles became his disciples. And Pilate condemned him to death on a cross, and those who had become his disciples preached his doctrine. They claimed that he appeared to them alive 3 days after his passion. Maybe he was the Messiah, about whom the prophets had spoken of miracles. Mm. So that's certainly... less grandiose than the other version. Mm-hmm.
We could be open to that one. At this point, I mean, just like our history, we can make our conclusions now, but we also have to be open to any future discoveries and see what we can do when those come out. Maybe textual criticism, we'll uncover some further clues later on in the future. Maybe we'll find new documents. I mean, heck, there was this talk going on about this first century copy of Mark that's been found lately. Who knows what the future holds?
Wow, I hadn't heard about that. Mm-hmm. This is very recent, is it?
Yes, it is. Craig Evans has had a lot to do with this one. Dan Wallace knows quite a bit about it as well. It's only started coming out. It looks like it was used in a mask somewhere. And even Bart Ehrman is responding to some. There's still a lot of debate on it, so nothing's written in stone, but it certainly is causing a lot of controversy.
Fascinating. Okay, Nick, Let's then move on to the alternative hypotheses that mythicists, of course, are required to propose to explain the data of the New Testament. Obviously, if they're going to stand a chance of credibility, then you simply can't say, I reject the New Testament, therefore Jesus doesn't exist. You've got to have some more plausible account as to how it is that we have the documents that we do in fact have. And so far as I can see, the main strategy, of course, this doesn't apply to everybody. I mean, for example, from my looking into this a little, I believe that Robert Price doesn't follow this. But Doherty and I believe that Carrier basically follow this kind of line. So let me just sketch it out here and I'll ask you what you think. So Paul's letters and some of the other letters in the New Testament are, you know, widely acknowledged to predate the writing of the Gospels in the New Testament. That's uncontroversial. However, Paul and these other writers display no knowledge of an historical person, Jesus of Nazareth. They talk about a Jesus, but not, it's not clear that they're talking about an historical person. Instead, they seem to be talking about a mythical, heavenly Christ figure, a cosmic Christ figure, not a flesh and blood human being, although I believe there's some difference of opinion between Doherty and Carrier on that one. But it's where this Christ figure appears. Is he on the earth or is he in some sort of heavenly state? Anyway, what happened then with the Gospels was that this cosmic figure then got talked about in allegorical ways in the Gospel of Mark, and after that became misunderstood as literal history. So could we start with this first contention here that Paul and other early letter writers didn't know of an historical human person, Jesus of Nazareth, who walked and talked and did his ministry and taught in Palestine?
Now, I've had some fun with some friends of mine lately, because we were on a message board on Facebook, and there was someone who was saying, well, geez, you know, you'd think Paul would mention things like the virgin birth, for instance. And this has become a huge joke for us, because we'll go into threads with each other on Facebook, and we'll just say things like, and by the way, I do affirm the virgin birth, because it comes with a strong idea that if Paul believes that he must have surely have affirmed it everywhere he went, no, that doesn't follow. Paul would have any number of reasons to not mention it, and one of the biggest ones would be there was no need to mention it. It wasn't relevant in any of his letters. I mean, is he going to write to the Corinthians, have any problems, and then say, hey, by the way, dudes, Jesus was virgin born? These were not people who were ignorant of Christianity entirely. They were believers in Christianity, and Paul lived in a society that's called a high-context society, where it's assumed the person has a fluent background of knowledge of the material that's being discussed. One example I tend to use this is the Federalist Papers here in America, that when they're writing, that they refer to events such as the Peloponnesian War and Greek heroes and Roman emperors and things of that sort, and they assume the reader knows what they're talking about. The reader thinks, oh, Peloponnesian War, yes, yes, I know the history right there. And they start to make the connections. We don't do that today. If you start talking about the Peloponnesian War, you have to explain everything about the Peloponnesian War, because, frankly, people aren't that educated about it.
Okay, well, that does make sense. I do understand that argument. But Doherty does make it stronger than just the virgin birth, and he does list a whole load of things. So let me just give you his quote here, because it does paint a very stark picture. Quote, in the first half century of Christian correspondence, including letters attributed to Paul and other epistles under names like Peter, James, and John, the gospel story cannot be found. When these writers speak of their divine Christ, echoes of Jesus of Nazareth are virtually inaudible, including details of a life and ministry, the circumstances of his death, the attribution of any teachings to him. No one speaks of miracles performed by Jesus, his apocalyptic predictions, his views on any of the great issues of the time. The very fact that he preached in person is never mentioned. His appointment of apostles or his directive to carry the message to the nations of the world is never appealed to. The great characters of the Jesus story, Mary, his mother, Joseph, his father, John, his herald, Judas, his betrayer, Pilate, his executioner, none of them receive a mention in all the Christian correspondence of the first century. As for holy places, there are none to be found, for not a single epistle writer breathes a word about any of the sites of Jesus' career, not even Calvary, where he died for the world's sins, or the empty tomb where he rose from the dead to guarantee a universal resurrection. So there we are. That's quite a list. Paul knows nothing about it.
How does that follow? Because he doesn't mention it, he doesn't know anything about it. Again, to use the same kind of argument, I could write several blog posts in a long time and never mention any of these events to some extent. Does that mean I don't believe in them? Of course not. The question we have to ask is, was there any reason for Paul to mention a lot of these? I mean, why should he mention, for instance, Jesus' mother and father? What does that have to do with what's going on? Paul is not writing a gospel. He is not writing a life of Jesus. None of the epistle writers are. They are writing to deal with issues that are going on at that church at the time. Their words are meant to be concise because writing was timely and expensive. They are dealing with the fundamental issues, and they are dealing with issues that are not necessarily covered in the oral tradition. The oral tradition meant quite a lot for people back then. One of the best books I'd recommend in studying how this kind of thing was going on in the ancient world is by John Walton and Brent Sandy. It's called The Lost World of Scripture. Very eye-opening to what was going on. Paul has no need to mention these things, and if all you've got is silence, that is a very weak case.
Well, can I just say that what really matters, it seems to me, and I take your point, is that what you would expect him to write if it was genuine, and of course we can argue about that, but I'm going to say to you, wouldn't you expect Paul to have mentioned the miracles performed by Jesus? Wouldn't you have expected him to talk about the empty tomb? Wouldn't you have expected him to talk about where he rose from the dead? Wouldn't you have expected him to mention Pilate as his executioner, things like that?
No. Why would I? I mean, were those really relevant? Is it going to help the Corinthians with the controversy of food offered to idols to know that Jesus worked miracles? This kind of stuff would be part of the oral tradition, and there would be people at these churches who were instructing the Christians on these matters. It wasn't relevant. And as for the place where these things occurred, that's placing an idea from later on the time. It's anachronistic. There's no need for Paul to mention many of these things. And if we're talking arguments from silence, one that I like to use, let's consider Hannibal, the Carthaginian general, the one who nearly conquered the Roman Empire at the time. This is a guy worth talking about. What do we find contemporary historians saying about him? Hardly anything. I mean, the first mention we find of him is about 50 years later. And yet we are supposed to think so often that Jesus, who as an adult never traveled outside of his area, never went to battle, never wrote a book, never ran for office, grew up as a child who would have been seen as illegitimate, grew up in a town with low honor, and we must take honor and shame seriously in studying Jesus, and died the most shameful death of all. And we were supposed to think, oh, surely everyone would have been talking about him and such. No, they wouldn't be. The Christians would be, and the Christians didn't need to be told things they already knew repeatedly. They were wanting answers to questions they did not know.
And would you also agree that really he is also, as we say here in the UK, over-egging his pudding, which just means exaggerating, of course, to make his point that, in fact, Paul does know things about Jesus, and Doherty has just avoided those facts.
He absolutely does know things about Jesus. I mean, Galatians, for instance, he talks about the brother of Jesus, James. He talks about being born of a woman under the law. That would refer to someone who lived on this earth who was under the law. In Romans, he talks about him being of a seed of David. In 1 Corinthians 11, he has the tradition of the Lord's Supper. And in 1 Corinthians 15, we have the tradition, the great creed about his resurrection appearances, which there is an empty tomb implied there. Now, one thing I do want to say, they talked about the language of passed on and received. And Carrier and others always say, well, this refers to divine revelation, because like when you go to 1 Corinthians 11, it says, what I received from the Lord Jesus. The problem with that is Craig Keener has pointed out where in his book on the historical Jesus that language was used by the rabbis, and they would say they received something from Sinai. That doesn't mean that Moses appeared to them or something like that. They are saying, this is the foundation of our material. Now, it doesn't take much thinking to know why 1 Corinthians 11 would be traced back to Jesus and 1 Corinthians 15 wouldn't be. 1 Corinthians 11 is traced back to Jesus because these are the words of Jesus. 1 Corinthians 15 isn't, because Jesus never rose from the dead in any case and said, "And I appeared to Peter, I appeared to the 500, I appeared to the apostles." That's not what Jesus said. The source in this case is the apostles themselves who made the creed.
Yes, and Gary Habermas, who was on this program, was saying that this most probably came from the church at Jerusalem when Paul went there just a few years after the resurrection. And we see this in Galatians 1. But the problem here, and this is something that Robert Price brings up, is that in Galatians 1, Paul actually specifically says that he did not receive the gospel from any human being. And that seems to contradict what we find in Corinthians 15, where he says, you know, "I passed on to you of first importance," then he lists this creed that seems to be, you know, outlining the gospel. And yet, you know, in Galatians 1, Paul says, "I didn't receive the gospel from human beings."
Well, what we have to be clear on is what is meant by the gospel. And what we're talking in this case is about the life of a historical Jesus and the details about what went on with him. That's not the same kind of gospel being given in 1 Corinthians 15. The gospel in 1 Corinthians 15 is about the historical Jesus, to be sure, but it's speaking specifically about the resurrection. What Paul is saying in Galatians is really saying that I didn't just hear this teaching from a man and believed it. I received the affirmation of it from God himself. And to be clear, Paul had to have content of what the gospel was when he was persecuting it. So it's, I don't even think we're really talking so much about content here. We're talking about affirmation of it. And if you read the language in Galatians 1, I think Paul is comparing himself to Jeremiah and speaking in the same language of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah faced some very harsh opposition, just as much as Paul was.
Well, I certainly agree when I was reading that article there by Robert Price that I thought he was making too much of the supposed difficulty that was there, which seems to be a feature of this kind of writing, in my opinion, anyway. Let's turn then to this idea of the cosmic Christ, which is supposedly what Paul actually did believe. So they were apparently talking about a heavenly cosmic Christ, not a human being coming down to earth. And here I'm actually indebted to Truth Search for sending me some notes, which I'm following here, and which seems to kind of summarize some of the mythicist writings that I've looked into. Now, will you please bear with me? I'm going to set this out and then ask you what you think of this. Okay, so this is the idea, which is pretty much a Doherty's kind of view. No doubt I've got some details wrong here, but I've got to work with something, haven't I? So apologies to those people out there who may be far more expert in this kind of thing than I am. Anyway, so the idea goes that Paul and whoever wrote the letters attributed to Paul, because some of those letters are disputed by scholars. Anyway, I'm just going to say, I'm going to call them all Paul's letters, all right, those that are bear Paul's name, right? So Paul believed something along these lines. "There is a spiritual reality to salvation, but that does not involve the Son of God coming from God to earth as a man and dying on the cross and being resurrected on earth in history. Rather, the spiritual reality of the redemption is spoken of in mythical terms. So the mythical character Jesus, this is before the creation, descended the seven levels of the spiritual heavens, and in the Aristotelian sublunar realm, the sort of heavenly middle realm, he took on the appearance of a human being, and then at the lowest of these spiritual levels, so not on earth, but at the lowest of these spiritual levels, the demons believed him to be a real human being and killed him." So that's where the, as it were, the crucifixion took place, not on earth. Now, we may think that sounds fanciful, but Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 6 to 8 are said to bear this out. So this is what Paul writes. He says, Among the mature, we do impart wisdom, although it is not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age, who are doomed to pass away. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom from God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. And the idea here is that when Paul is talking about the rulers of the age, these are not kings or emperors. These are clearly demons. So the demons crucified Jesus, and they did so in this sort of mid-heaven state of being, because that's where the demons live. They crucified the Lord of glory, and this wisdom has been hidden since the beginning of time. Now, we might doubt that Paul is speaking about demons here when he says the rulers of this age, but that's corroborated in Paul's letter to the Ephesians in chapter 6, verse 12, and I'll read that. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So when Paul is talking about rulers there, he's talking about these demons. So if we go back then to the 1 Corinthians, he's saying that the demons killed Jesus. And where would they do that? They wouldn't do that on earth, would they? They would do that in this kind of spiritual mid-place, sublunar realm. Now, there's more to say about this, but what's your reaction to that so far, Nick?
You know, one of the mistakes a lot of people make is you read one term and assume the term has the exact same meaning everywhere else, and it can mean very, very different things. Now, there's no doubt the word archons, translated as rulers in authorities and such, can refer to spiritual beings, sure. There's also no doubt it can refer to earthly beings. Thing is, Paul usually gives modifiers. In Ephesians 6, for instance, he talks about cosmic powers, and he makes it clear he's talking about spiritual warfare. If you go back to 1 Corinthians to read everything that's going on in that passage, when he's talking about the wisdom of his age, the philosopher, and things of that sort, he's talking about earthly events. So if we're going to be judging this by looking at the modifiers, we should say this is an earthly event.
All right, so let me bring up some supporting evidence for the argument from non-biblical sources here, and this seems to be appealed to quite a lot. This is a Jewish stroke Christian text called the Ascension of Isaiah, which many of these mythicists, I think they would say this is difficult to date, but it's arguable that it contains traditions that were shared by Paul and other New Testament letter writers. And the key passage is this one. So this is from the Ascension of Isaiah. So, as I say, it's a Jewish Christian text. It's not in the Bible, but it's floating around there in the first century kind of time. So this is from chapter 9, verses 13 to 17. I quote, "The Lord will descend into the world in the last days, he who is to be called Christ after he has descended and become like you in form, and they will think that he is flesh and a man. And the God of that world will stretch out his hand against the sun, and they will lay their hands upon him and hang him upon a tree, not knowing who he is. And thus his descent, as you will see, will be concealed from the heavens, so that it will not be known who he is. And when he has plundered the angel of death, he will rise on the third day and will remain in the world for 545 days. And then many of the righteous will ascend with him." Now, when I read that, I immediately thought that that looked like a docetic text. So this is the idea that Jesus only seemed to be a man, but otherwise this seemed pretty much as if it was talking about the crucifixion of Jesus on the earth. But Doherty is saying that he says it's not docetic. This is happening in the realm of the spirits, and this is because there are a number of reasons which he gives, but I think the best reasons he gives is that this is the God of the world, Satan, is the one that's killing Jesus here. So this is going to take place in the realm of Satan, the realm of the demons. There's no mention of Jesus' ministry or his trial or an execution as we normally think of it in the Gospels. Satan just grabs this Son of God figure, this Christ figure, hangs him on a tree. The whole thing feels very mythological. This is what he's arguing. And in fact, he even argues that references to Christ or Jesus may actually be interpolations. So the idea here is that this was floating around in the culture, and people like Paul and other writers had this kind of thing in their mind, really. They had mythology in their mind.
That's his assertion, and that's what he needs to demonstrate. Part of the problem here is that, as you said, it's difficult to date the document. I tend to think that it's a Jewish document. It does, in fact, have some Christian assertions and parts that were added in later on. And it's always best to go with what we know to be the primary reliable documents and interpret the secondary documents in light of those instead of going the other way around. And there's a reason you thought this was a docetic passage and you read it that way, because frankly, that's what it is. It makes the most sense, and especially when it says that they will think him to be a man. Where if all of this is happening in some sublunar realm instead of on Earth, who on Earth is going to think Jesus to be a man then when this is going on and no one can see it taking place? That doesn't make much sense at all. What makes better sense to leading scholars today is just simply that Jesus was a man who historically existed. It explains all the data we have far better. Now, we can differ amongst ourselves as to what this historical Jesus did, what he taught. Did he rise from the dead? Did he consider himself divine? Did he consider himself a Messiah? Things of that sort. But to debate whether or not he existed, that's not going on. And the ascension of Isaiah really hasn't changed that.
Yeah, and when it says the God of the world will stretch out his hand, when I first looked at that, it doesn't say to me that this is happening in a sublunar realm.
It doesn't.
What I immediately think about that is that that is a kind of a theological commentary on the history that's taking place.
Absolutely.
Jesus is being crucified, and the spiritual motivation behind that is coming from Satan. That seems to be the obvious way to read it.
Yeah, when I'm thinking about comparison, I'd be like saying that the Israelites could have thought that the Exodus took place in some sort of sublunar realm because they said that our God delivered us through the waters. You have God acting in the Old Testament numerous times, and every Jew believed it because this was the word of God. And writers from other parts later on, they were entirely open to dark forces acting in our world. I think what Doherty is doing is he's taking a modern dichotomy and reading it into the ancient world. This is one reason when I do discussions online and such, I avoid the natural supernatural distinction. I don't really think there's anything to it. I think it's a modern anachronism. Mm.
I think it's a very good point. I'm going to carry on now to somebody else's take on this. So this is Richard Carrier, and in one handout that mm-hmm. he wrote in 2006, he gives his version of sort of timetable of events in his version of the mythicist view here. And when he gets to between 64 and 70 AD, he says there's a lot of persecution by Nero, and this devastates the church in Rome. There's a Jewish war, 66 AD. This ends the church in Jerusalem. And then he says we have the Gospel of Mark written around this time. And the Gospel of Mark is intended to be allegorical. So we have this view of which you've just been discussing, this mythical Christ figure, but for some reason Mark comes along and he writes this mythical story as if it looks like history, but it's still allegory. But after that, and so we're looking about between 70 and 100, he says that many new Christians start to believe that the myths are real and assume that Jesus is a real person. And around this time, we get the Gospel of Matthew being written. So it seems as if people, Matthew and Luke, have both misunderstood Mark's intention here. And now we're getting an historical story being written. How do you react to this narrative that's going on here by Richard Carrier?
I really don't think this is going to get any traction at all in the scholarly community. For one thing, it's interesting to note that he's relying on Mark being a late document, and maybe it was, but I find it fascinating that someone like James Crossley is saying we can date the Gospel of Mark to the 40s as it's writing. But of course, we all know that James Crossley, he's a born-again evangelical fundamentalist. No, he's an atheist. Now, the idea that Mark is writing an allegory, I've read Carrier's book on this, and there are so many times that it's a huge stretch with what he says. Like, he makes claims about the readers of all these Greek figures, and I'm looking for this is stretching it beyond credulity. I really don't think that this could be done. It's like you're reading something that's made just to support the claim. It's entirely ad hoc. Like I've said, the Gospels fit more into the genre of Greco-Roman biographies. And to think that Matthew and Luke, those who were present, just totally misread Mark and did totally terrible history. I mean, Luke specifically says he went and talked to eyewitnesses and looked at other sources, and but he just did this terrible history. But lo and behold, here we've come, and about 20 centuries later, we found out that Matthew and Luke were both entirely wrong on the reading of Mark, and we have a reading of Mark totally new that has not been accepted in church history whatsoever, and we're the right ones.
Yeah, I agree with you. This word ad hoc is very suitable for this. It seems to be one ad hoc assumption after another, mm-hmm. always to the point, to the case being argued. And, you know, when you get so many of those lined up, as we do seem to have here, mm-hmm. it seems much simpler just to accept that there was, in fact, this guy, Jesus, walking around and teaching, and out of this came disciples who wrote about it and passed it on.
Yeah. Many atheists believe in a historical Jesus and go on to lead happy and meaningful lives.
Right. Nicely put. Okay, well, there's just a last thing here, and this is the... Again, I don't think everybody goes for this. I have a feeling that Robert Price doesn't really go for this one. I'm not sure about that. Anyway, Doherty does a bit, especially this person, Acharya S. does. And this is the view that, you know, in surrounding ancient Near East cultures, they often had these mythological dying and rising god figures in their cultures.
Oh,
and
goody.
This is put forward, presumably, this is making the supposedly mythical roots of the Jesus story more plausible. So we have mythological characters floating around like Mithras, Dionysus, Attis, Osiris, Isis, and according to the film Zeitgeist, we have amazing parallels between Jesus and the Egyptian god Horus. So because there were all these mythological characters around, that makes it more plausible to think that Jesus started as a mythological character as well. What do you think? Does it make it any more plausible?
Well, you know, I have to say, these guys have some of the best scholarship of the century. If you're talking about the 19th century, that is. No. These dying and rising gods, the claims really don't match up when you look at the various sources that are used to argue on this. I, in fact, did do an interview with someone on my show on this point, and he's doing his whole PhD dissertation on the very topic, Joe Marva here, and we talked about various pagan deities, and in many cases, the evidence isn't there. Probably one of the leading books you can read on this right now is Medinger's book, Riddle of a Resurrection, and in the end, he says, the resurrection of Jesus is different from all of these. It's not something seasonal, it's not based on an everyday event, and it's based on historical realities that scholars can determine took place.
But we do have in these characters dying and rising, don't we? So do you want to tell us anything about any of these? How about Attis?
Attis, we really don't have a case of him dying and rising. Much from what I gather, all we've seen is a finger of his that came back and that it started moving. So again, that's hardly resurrection. And what we have to keep in mind when we talk about resurrection, we must mean resurrection. We must mean what the Jews would have meant and understood on it at the time, that it was returning to an earthly life again. In the case of Jesus, it was a glorified earthly life to never die again. And we do not see this in the others. It's more connected to a sort of seasonal event a lot of times.
But one could say that it's sufficient that you would have a dying and rising, and then you could tack on to that an eternal state, that you rise to an eternal state. But that could be tacked on, couldn't it? You could say that the general pattern of dying and then rising accounts for resurrection.
Not really. The ancient world wasn't too keen on the idea of resurrection. It was a book that God raised him from the dead. The name of the author escapes me every time. And he looks at the views of resurrection in the ancient world. And resurrection really wasn't looked at on highly. I mean, as those are Christian fundamentalist scholars like John Dominic Crossan has pointed out in his book on In Search of Paul, when Socrates dies, for instance, in the Phaedo, he asks that a gift be presented to the god of healing at his death. Why? He's receiving the ultimate healing. He's being removed from his body, which is a really good thing. To return to the body would be like returning to prison again. Why would you want that? And what it is you can take all these accounts, you can find a mixed mash of things, and then you can apply the word resurrection to it later on.
Well, so that would be true of the more sort of Greek element of this. But what about the Egyptian element? I mean, is it not the case that Osiris has some kind of resurrection?
Osiris was cut in pieces. His wife Isis came and looked for the pieces, put them all together. There was one piece she couldn't find, but I'm not going to say anything because I think this is a family show, and I'll let the listeners decide what piece I'm talking about. But let's say shortly after that, she did put that piece to use. And Osiris, he came back to life again. He came back to life in the underworld, didn't return to an earthly life again. And then we also have to look and say, where were his followers promised that they would rise in resurrected bodies again? Where? Not really. That's something that made Christianity unique. Christianity taught the resurrection of the body. And that would have been seen as repugnant to the Gentiles. You know, if the Christians were making up a story as they went on, they want to make it more acceptable for non-Christian readers, they would have removed bodily resurrection.
Well, okay. Let me ask you then, and this is not something that I think would be accepted by the serious mythicist writers, but a lot of people who are attracted to mythicism I think will have been influenced by this. So I'm making that qualification there so that those people who are seriously into studying this mythicist point of view would not take this seriously, I'm quite sure. Right. But I think it needs to be said because it is so influential. And of course, this is the film Zeitgeist and the particular claims that are made here about Jesus and Horus, the Egyptian god Horus, being very close in so many ways. And so I'm just going to read here a transcription of just a little portion of what's said in that film. So here we have, broadly speaking, the story of Horus is as follows.
Horus was born on December 25th of the Virgin Isis Mary. His birth was accompanied by a star in the east, and upon his birth he was adored by three kings. At the age of 12, he was a prodigal child teacher. At the age of 30, he was baptized by a figure known as Anup, and thus began his ministry. Horus had 12 disciples he traveled about with, performing miracles such as healing the sick and walking on water. Horus was known by many gestural names such as the Truth, the Light, God's Anointed Son, the Good Shepherd, the Lamb of God, and many others. After being betrayed by Typhon, Horus was crucified, buried for 3 days, and thus resurrected.
So there we have it. According to the film Zeitgeist, it's incredibly close. So clearly the Christians just copied this or were heavily influenced by this.
Yeah. After my roommate I was living with at the time and I saw Zeitgeist together, we were left immediately with one burning question. Who do we sue to get the last 2 hours of our life back? The sources in Zeitgeist, they're non-scholars citing other outdated non-scholars who weren't really treated as scholars in their own time. And you look at these claims, you're not going to find these claims about Horus backed by Egyptologists today. They're just not there. Unfortunately, on the internet, yes, you can find some good, true things on the internet, but you have to know how to sift through the data. Where, and too many people do not know how to do that. Most of us sadly just look and say, well, I already believe it, so that settles it. And I've gone to friends and family who have put quotes up on the internet, and I've done some digging into each of these quotes and said, you need to take this down. this is false, even if it's something that I could agree with. I mean, we must remember that great quote of Abraham Lincoln. The problem with internet quotes is they're too easy to make up.
Oh, dear. And, of course, it goes on with others as well, talking about Attis and Krishna and Dionysus and Mithra.
Oh, yeah.
And makes all these very precise links to Jesus.
Mithra is one of my favorites. Mithra, he was born of a virgin. That is, if you count a rock as a virgin, for instance.
Right. Uh-huh.
When
12 disciples?
Those 12 disciples are actually the signs of the zodiac. In fact, we don't have Mithraic writings. What we know about Mithras comes largely from their critics, such as the Christians, and artwork that we've found. Now, you try and figure out what all about a movement from their critics and the artwork, and it can be very difficult to do.
So we can't say for sure that he died and was buried for 3 days and then resurrected?
We have no record of him dying at all. Some great resources I'd use on this, my ministry partner, J.P. Holding's Shattering the Christ Myth. He covers each of these quite a lot, and he's got a long, long section there on Zeitgeist. And my friend Albert McLehinney, who runs the Laborum site and that podcast, he's writing a whole series on Jesus mythicism that's available on Amazon. Now, you might say, these are non-scholars. Yeah, these friends of mine, they are non-scholars, but they do write and they do cite the leading scholars today. Frankly, a lot of scholars in the field, it's like, we've got better time to do than to spend dealing with this kind of stuff. We want to deal with what's really relevant in the community today. And thing about Mithras, I actually like to make memes sometimes to illustrate my arguments that I think are really fun. And I do have a meme of the rock driving, with the rock saying to his passenger in the backseat, "You know, Mithras was born of a virgin, right?" And his passenger replies, "Actually, he was born from the rock." That leads to the rock looking stunned.
Yes, it doesn't have quite the same ring, does it? Yes, Mithra of Persia, born of a rock on the 25th of December. I don't even know if the 25th of December is...
The 25th of December, in fact, we don't have record of these deities being born on that day. In fact, we don't have record explicitly of Jesus being born on that day. No. We do have some historical evidence that he could have been born on that day. Again, my ministry partner wrote about this in his ebook, Christmas is Pagan and Other Myths. So I think it could be Jesus was born on that day, but it's not a hero I'm willing to die on. And it's taking a later idea and saying that this is what was going on. And I just find it extremely coincidental to think that all these pagan deities all around the world, all of them just decided to have a birthday on December 25th. Maybe it could be that December 25th was added on later on to reply to the Christians.
Yeah. Yeah, so, right, okay, so Jesus could have been born on that day, and Mithra could have been born of a rock on that day, and it just doesn't lead you anywhere, does it? Okay, so let's leave that then, certainly leave the film Zeitgeist there, but let's leave the whole idea there of the pagan references and pagan influences, and just have a brief mention of Robert Price's view, and I think he distances himself from that in a strong way anyway, as I don't know his writings in much detail at all, but what I've picked up from, he's much more arguing that Jesus was, and I'm going to put this in inverted commas, fulfilling messianic expectations in the Old Testament, in the sense that those who wrote about this supposedly historical character, of course I believe that he was historical, but from what we're talking about here, the supposedly historical character, they wrote such as to turn the Old Testament messianic prophecies, the prophecy that a Messiah would come, to turn those into history, and that is what we're reading. We're seeing these Old Testament prophecies come to life in this literary form, but it's not talking about a real person.
I really find something like this stretching, because if you are wanting to create a Messiah figure, you would not create Jesus. Jesus is the last kind of Messiah figure you want to create. I mean, if I was writing a book for first century people and writing a book called How Not to Create a Religion, Christianity would be the prime example I would use. With the virgin birth, for instance, people would not look at Mary and say, "Oh, she's pregnant out of wedlock. Oh, she's saying it's a virgin birth. A miracle must have occurred." They would have looked at her and said, "Boy, you know, look at her. She got herself knocked up like that, and guess what? She's blaming God for it. I mean, how ridiculous is that? I mean, couldn't she admit, like, she got raped or something? That would make far more sense. And then you would not have your Messiah being raised in the area of Nazareth. Nazareth was not a town worth talking about. It was a low honor town. And to the ancient world then, for them, honor and shame were primary.
Sure. Yeah, okay, but wouldn't you, let's take something more fundamental theologically, much more serious theologically. Let's say, wouldn't you have your Messiah dying? After all, if we go to Isaiah 53, here we have the suffering servant, and it looks very much as if this suffering servant dies. It's a sin offering, and could it not be, therefore, that this is understood as to be messianic, and then people thought, well, we need to write this story of our Messiah conforming to Isaiah 53?
Let's suppose, first off, if you're making a Messiah, more likely you're going to make a Messiah that will conquer Rome. The very people at the time were still thinking Messiah meant liberation from Rome. That was the great enemy to defeat, and it wasn't. Let's suppose you decide to make a Messiah who would die. I can understand maybe making one that could die. I do not understand making one that would die the most shameful, hideous death possible that no one would ever want to talk about. I mean, that would be like making up a figure to be the president of a Southern Baptist Convention who was a convicted pedophile. You don't do that. The normal idea was the Messiah will conquer. He will defeat the Roman Empire. That was one of the great deliverances. That's one more reason. In fact, a lot of people today would not think Jesus was the Messiah. Which you would say, well, did Jesus reinstitute God's kingdom on earth? Did he return us to the glory that we were meant to have? Now, from my perspective, I'd say, yes, Jesus did reinstitute God's kingdom on earth. And God's kingdom is growing and spreading right now. Mm. The thing is, it's not the kingdom you were expecting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you. And actually, if you look back into the Old Testament, then you do find intimations of that view of the real Jesus who lived and died and resurrected. But it's not absolutely crystal clear from the point of view of people actually standing in Old Testament times that they could just read that off absolutely clearly. Would you agree that there was some ambiguity in their shoes if you were back in those times reading these texts?
Oh, yeah, of course. And so would Peter. Peter wrote that the prophets themselves longed to look into and know exactly what they were prophesying about, but we live in a time where we're actually seeing what happened.
Okay, the last person I will ask you to comment on, and this is only because his book has been publicized in the last, 4 years since he published it? This is Joseph Atwill, who wrote this book called Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus. Again, I'm not putting this forward as the kind of thing that a serious mythicist would entertain, but nevertheless, mentioning it because of it's been talked about quite a lot, and the fact that it puts forward a different theory, whether you think there's anything to this or not, but this is just what it says on the blurb. Was Jesus the invention of a Roman emperor? The author of this groundbreaking book believes he was. Caesar's Messiah reveals the key to a new and revolutionary understanding of the origin of Christianity, explaining what is the New Testament, who is the real Jesus, and how Christ's second coming already occurred. The clues leading to these startling conclusions are found in the writing of the first century historian Flavius Josephus, whose War of the Jews is one of the only historical chronicles of this period. Closely comparing the work of Josephus with the New Testament Gospels, Caesar's Messiah demonstrates that the Romans directed the writing of both. Their purpose? To offer a vision of a peaceful Messiah who would serve as an alternative to the revolutionary leaders who were rocking first century Israel and threatening Rome. Similarly, Caesar's Messiah will rock our understanding of Christian history as it reveals that Jesus was a fictional character portrayed in four Gospels, written not by Christians, but Romans. Okay, Nick, so is that the one that perhaps we should follow instead?
Oh, good grief. Oh, good grief. Seriously. I mean, Akoya S. and Richard Carrier both want to distance themselves from this one. And if those two together are saying this theory isn't worthwhile, that's making quite a statement. And it's quite tremendous to have a non-scholar come out and say his theory is groundbreaking and revolutionary, And that seems to be a common trend going today, that so many non-scholars write books saying that they have seen through that Jesus is not a historical figure, and they are going to share that all the world, and they are using pretty much the exact same arguments in some variant or another. But to say the Romans invented Jesus, why on earth would they do that? The Romans were constantly trying to put down the Christians, and if the Romans wanted to deal with Judaism in the Jewish area, there was a far better way to do that. It's called using an army. And they did that in 70 AD. They conquered Jerusalem. This was the most powerful empire in the world. And no scholar has thought the Romans invented Jesus. None.
Yeah, but you see, Nick, they'd rather avoid having a conflict like that. So they designed this idea that they would write a peaceful Messiah who would pacify the Jews, you see, who would believe that their Messiah had actually now arisen on the scene and was teaching them this peaceful way of life, and that would calm everybody down, and then Rome wouldn't have to send in the army.
Oh, yeah, Jesus, he sure was a peaceful Messiah. He only went into the temple and started throwing everything around and told people his father's house wouldn't be made a den of robbers. And yeah, he was so peaceful, he was brought before Pilate, and the charge was that he was claiming to be a king, and Pilate had to deal with him. Yeah, that's the kind of Messiah that the Romans would invent, someone who would challenge them and say, Caesar is not king. Right. When people want to believe this kind of stuff, I always want to offer them a really sweet deal. I have some oceanfront property in Montana that's for sale, and I will sell it very cheap to these people.
Okay, Nick, yeah, I'll put in a bid for that. That's great. Okay, well, let's just finish then with some sort of thoughts about this to wrap up with. Why do you think that people are attracted to this mythicist, well, this collection of ideas? I mean, you can you can be an atheist, you can argue in much more plausible ways against the claims of Christianity. I mean, I would say unsuccessfully, of course, because I believe that Christianity is true, but nevertheless, you could have a much more plausible way of arguing against it. So why do you think that people bother with mythicism?
I really think that Ben Witherington is onto something when he says we live in a Jesus-haunted culture that is biblically illiterate. And I think there can be a sort of anti-Christianity out there that wants to go against anything whatsoever if it lends any truth at all to Christianity. I think of a quote, it could be from Chesterton for all I know, but it's not, I think it's very Chestertonian. If a man will not believe the truth, he'll believe anything else. And there are so many people that seem to be so terrified, in which case, of finding anything factual whatsoever in the Bible, as if that's game, set, match. Again, it's all or nothing thinking.
Yes, is that the quote where it says that people will believe anything, so as long as it's not written in the Bible?
That could be the case. This is part of our poor thinking going on today. It's not just atheists. Christians also have a lot of poor thinking going on, and the internet is affecting that because we frankly don't know too much how to sift through the information, and very few of us sit down and read books anymore. I often ask people, if you're going to go out and debate these ideas, when was the last time you read a scholarly book on a subject that disagreed with you? I usually get crickets at that point. And some people have written on the way this is working on us. There was a book out, for instance, The Dumbest Generation. Don't trust anyone under 30 because our generation does not study. And I think it's Nicholas Carr who's written a book, The Shallows, about how the internet is affecting the way our minds think because we don't know how to evaluate information anymore.
Mm-mm. Well, it's good because both you and I are over 30. I'm certainly over 30. Yeah. So we're not included in that, so we're all right. No, but I mean, you could say that the internet is a mixed blessing.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people point to the fact that the internet actually is this great liberation of information, and people didn't have access to all sorts of information in the past. But I do agree that we need to be very careful about this, and we do need to sift information. I think the best people in the alternative media are actually trying very hard to achieve that. I won't bother to name names, but many people will know who, the kind of people I'm talking about, and so that it's not a case of just anything goes. We're being much more and more careful about actually what's being claimed, and helping people to think and not just take things at face value.
I'm not sure if you've seen it over there across the pond, but we have a commercial that can come on here with a lady talking to a guy about things that she read on the internet. Says, you believe that? Yeah, of course I do. If I can't point anything on the internet unless it's not true. And where'd you hear that? On the internet. And here comes this guy up there and he says, oh, here's my date. He's a man on the internet. He's a French martyr. And you come up, you know he's not a French martyr. He just goes, bonjour. And we laugh at that, but that is the exact kind of thinking going on that we live, unfortunately, in a culture where people would just go and they'll put up a link that they probably haven't even really studied themselves, that, well, here, this settles it.
Absolutely. But it's instructive, isn't it? Because, I mean, one of the reasons why the alternative media, in this widest sense, the internet, has taken off and produces that kind of attitude is because there are many ways in which it has become apparent that people are being manipulated and lied to through mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to be very careful of all kinds of media, don't we? And this is a message that I think, as I say, is coming through the best people, in particularly in the alternative media, is to say, just because it comes from a mainstream source doesn't mean it's false.
Yeah.
And just because it comes from an alternative source doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah.
We have to use our critical faculties and the best research we can in order to sift through these things. So,
I mean, I'm saying get the best books by scholars and on both sides that you can find. But those books aren't infallible either. Yes, scholars can and do make mistakes and do come to false conclusions. But all things being equal, a scholar is more of a force to be taken seriously than a non-scholar. If I go to a doctor could misdiagnose me with a disease. Sure, but that doesn't mean that I'm just as well off going to my mechanic to seeing what he thinks is wrong with me. I'm going to the doctor first because all things being equal, the doctor's opinion is best.
Well, that certainly makes sense, yes. And there's one last thing that I want to say before we end, and this is an observation that was made by Tim O'Neill, who is a very good atheist blogger. I think he's got some fantastic articles up there. He does his work very carefully. I do recommend people. I'll just put a link to that in the notes. Tim O'Neill. And he makes a point that if the original gospel was in fact mythical, why is it that we have no trace of this from antiquity? And he says that, you know, that would have been very useful for Christianity's critics. It would have been very good for the Gnostics, who would love to have had a fully spiritual Jesus. So he says there's no mention of this. And in his opinion, that's, you know, it's one of the kill switches for this whole group of theories, really. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. What we say about the argument from silence is where we would expect silence, the argument from silence is weak. Now, if there was a time where we would not expect silence, then it starts looking a bit better. I mean, Christians mention so many of their critics right at the start, but you never see them arguing against this movement that was supposedly around, was supposedly so dominant. It's not mentioned at all. That is a very telling silence.
Yeah. So even when the Gnostics talk about Jesus, they assume that he was actually... Well, he did exist, but they have a different spin on what it was that he taught.
Yeah, he existed. He existed. He just really wasn't material. He just appeared that way.
Mm-hmm. Back to docetism again. It was not where I expected to end. Anyway, Nick, thank you very much. It's been great speaking to you. Before we do actually close formally, I'd like to give you the opportunity to get out the information about your blog and podcast.
Oh, yeah. My blog can be found at deeperwaters.ddns.net. And I do a podcast every week, and I interview the best guests that I can find in Christian scholarship and apologetics. And if you go on Amazon, you'll find I've got some ebooks there, two of them written by my ministry partner, J.P. Holding. One of them is Defining Inerrancy. The other one is Groundless, a look at Dan Barker. And then one I've got on my own that I wrote for my church, actually, because we read the Apostles' Creed regularly. So I wrote an ebook on the Apostles' Creed.
Cool.
And of course, you do have a tremendous list of people who you've spoken to, and I do recommend people go and check those out because you've got some great interviews there, and I've dipped into that a bit myself. It is a really valuable resource there. So as I said before, Nick, it has been really great speaking with you, this time properly, not in the context of a debate, sure. Which, you know, does have its restrictions, doesn't it, on what you can say and when you can say things. And thanks for sharing with us your reaction to these various mythicist claims. I'm sure that I've not represented their case as well as I could have done, but these are the materials that I found in preparation for this interview. I'm sure I've made some mistakes, and I'm sure that I will receive some emails telling me that I made some mistakes. But anyway, it's been great speaking to you, and I'm sure this subject we will revisit sometime. So thanks again, Nick, for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.